Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two awesome sponsors for you. Environments for Humans are promoting their Access U Summit, online summit all about accessibility. Check that out at accessusummit.com. And welcoming Campaign Monitor. We actually use Campaign Monitor right on Shop Talk Show to deliver emails to you of new episodes. We'll tell you more about all the stuff they do in that conference later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off. Hello and welcome to yet another live episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, a podcast all about front-end-ish web design and development. I am Dave Rupert, and with me is Christopher Coyer.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the show. And this week we have on Mr. Brian Jones and Guy Meyer. How you doing, Brian, first?
good morning, everybody. I'm doing well.
Nice. And Guy, what's up, man?
Hey, guys. How's everyone doing?
Good.
I like it.
Double horns on the ball, Dave. I'm glad you had your coffee this morning.
I had some coffee. I am staring at this soundboard.
I like donut charts. I think they're super rad.
I'm staring at it like it's an old friend. Good. It's like picking up an old guitar.
Good. So this should be an interesting show. The topic of build tools and, you know, how can I have my computer help me do all the front end tasks that I needed to do is a prevalent and ever present topic here at Shop Talk Show. And one particular tool to help us do those things that comes up all the time, is CodeKit. I know most of us, let's get into the Mac versus PC thing later, but CodeKit happens to be a Mac app that does tons of front end stuff for you. The creator and programmer, coder, owner stuff of that is Brian. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually a retired Mac developer. I'm now a professional email replier. That was my former career.
I suppose, as you do, it's Guy, you help with the website, but it's largely a one man show as far as support and stuff for CodeKit. Or is that how it works? Or do you guys work together on everything?
There was a lot of feedback because I'm kind of one of Brian's target audiences, kind of being that designer that, you know, wanted to get into pre-processing, and someone who just doesn't maybe use all the features, but to help focus CodeKit 2 on someone who, you know, just does the design, wants to get into pre-processing. I did help him with the actual interface design for CodeKit 2, though, along with the website.
Oh, nice. Cool. But you don't have access to support at CodeKit.com or whatever.
I've got a direct line.
He'll call me at 8 p.m. and tell me something's not working, and then I have to fix it for him on the spot.
It's usually a missing comma or something like that.
Yeah, tell me about it. Sounds a little bit like myself in the early days. So just for those people that don't know, let's make sure that this is very clear what CodeKit is and what it does and stuff. Now, you know, not to make it a big advertisement, because that's largely what we're going to talk about this show, because it's kind of a big deal in the web community. Let's put a point on it. You want to give the spiel of it a little bit?
Sure. So the way I explain it to people is that CodeKit's an app that makes it easier and faster for professional web developers to build websites. And it does that by kind of automating a lot of stuff that you'd otherwise have to do by hand, such as, you know, compiling all the bleeding edge languages, less Sass, Stylus, Jade, Haml. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of them. And then, you know, checking JavaScript for errors, minifying files, and then, you know, also reloading browsers and new in 2.0 across devices. So, you know, it kind of takes a load off of you and lets you spend more time in your editor and less time doing everything else.
Nice. That was very succinct. Good way to do it.
I've given the elevator pitch a time or two.
Yeah, it's good. So expand on a little bit. What Brian is saying is, I don't know, you might read a blog like CSS Tricks and I might start to be a little obnoxious about, you know, I might even accidentally post CSS snippets for things just in Sass, because I just kind of like assume the world is using it, even though I should probably maybe stop doing that. But whatever you hear about SaaS constantly, stuff like that, or stylus or less, you know, like that's just almost taken for granted these days. Everybody's using these things to write their CSS. Well, you can't just write a .less file and send it up to your server, but it just doesn't work. Your browser has no idea what to do with that. So they're called preprocessors for a reason. They need to be processed. That less code needs to be turned into a CSS file. So you got to do that. Something needs to help you do that. And often these tools are so nerdy that the source of SAS is that the only way you can do it is through a command line tool. And plenty of people are 100% comfortable with that. And more people are less comfortable with that. Like, I don't know, you have to type SAS compile. I don't even know what the command is. That's how not nerdy I am is about stuff like that. So wouldn't it be cool if there was an app that just kind of made this easier? It ran those command line tools for us, and I guess that's where CodeKit steps in, right? It's like it's a user interface to abstract those difficult or uncomfortable or annoying command line things away from us. So it just does it in the app. Maybe that's a longer explanation.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty good.
I found it really helpful for myself, and then even just onboarding designers or people who like fear the command line for a right reason, because like you can erase your whole hard drive by typing the wrong thing. But like, it's really awesome just to be like, here, install this, click the plus button or whatever it is now, and just like point it at a directory and done. Like, it'll start doing things for you. Mm-hmm. It's pretty kind of cool. Like, it lowers that barrier to entry, and I think that's like the biggest thing in the world for people, is to like lower the hurdle in terms of like getting onto the pre-processing train and all that. So, yeah,
it's more than abstracting the nerdiness away, though. I mean, think of all those commands you have to run to get set up on a project, and the I don't know.
This is a fact. If you try to install Ruby by yourself, you die.
Yes,
it's like you know, it's like you know, install Ruby death. You die. Yeah.
It just says you die. Period. On the
yeah, it just says sorry.
So, but you know, you might have, so if you can imagine the CodeKit interface, if you've never seen it, maybe just go to the website of it, which is unusual, right? It's not CodeKit.com. It's something else. I forget what it is.
Yeah. So it's a funny story. There's a guy named Michael Dick that snagged it. It came up for auction and he snagged it. And then I tried to buy it from him. I tried to get in touch with him and he won't reply to any of my emails or tweets. So, I don't have
Michael,
that domain.
Please reply.
Right. Maybe you can get one of those new fancy TLDs for it.
Yeah.
CodeKit.bicycle
or
whatever. Yeah. Why not? You'll never forget how to use it then. It's at incident57.com/CodeKit. So that'll get, at least if you've never seen the interface for it, you can go and kind of look at what it looks like there. But imagine, you know, a sidebar, and I know that's optional now in CodeKit 2.0, but a sidebar full of different projects. And those could be folders of WordPress themes. They could be the root directory of a bunch of websites, whatever. But I'm just looking at mine, and I've recently kind of cleaned shop in there, and there's still about 10 of them in there. And that's what I think about how this is I'm too lazy to learn the command line. It's like
the commode line.
Listen, Mr. Merrill Burrows.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry, commode
that
line.
Would be a lot of command line tabs open, CD'd to different directories. You'd be typing commands in all day long, or you could have none open and just have this app be watching for files that just so happen to end in .css. And as soon as I save them from my code editor, it automatically processes them and put them in the place that I told them that they should be, and automatically runs auto prefixer on them after that has happened. And every time I drop a new image in there, it runs an optimizer on all this stuff that would be like, yeah, you could write the command for it, but what a pain in the butt. It's not about not knowing how to do those things. It's about making it convenient to happen. So I know we said it wasn't going to be an ad. It turns into being this big love fest for it, but.
And you could buy it using code ShopTech. No,
that's not even a thing. You don't even need a code. You can just choose to pay less. It's kind of an interesting system. At a minimum, $29, though. Anyway, so that's what these guys do. Maybe we could, do we have any, we're going to get more into it just because this is a Q&A show and people have questions about how this stuff goes down. So we'll end up talking more about it. Do we have any other news or drama to share, Dave?
Oh, there's just too much drama on the internet. So I'm just going to skip over it because I would rather feel lighter about my day. There was something, we always get that question, right? Mentoring. How do I become a mentor? How do I tell I'm mentoring? Yeah, I feel like it's come up on like the last three shows, you know. I wanted to let you guys know, somebody wrote in, I need to find that email. Do you have that email, Chris? Or
what are you talking about? It's about the WP Mentor thing?
WPmentor.org.
That's right. And it was a fellow named Matt Medeiros. And he just says, I created this thing and it's about mentorships and it's kind of bi-directional, right? It's like, I want to be a mentor or I am, you know, a person that wishes to be, is it a mentee, I guess, or
mentee and mentor. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're like, well, for one, let's just share it. Cause I think that's interesting. WPmentor.org and how it's interesting, how it's kind of connecting those two people, which is that's the difficult part. Right. And we were just saying on a previous show that mentors probably aren't, you know, as Matt puts it, they're not, you know, lining up around the block to, you know, be like, I have a bunch of extra time. Could you, you know, could I please answer emails about anything? But there are some, and it's a good thing, you know, like we've said in the past, Dave has tried it before to kind of help young people out in the world. And then we're like, this is extra, maybe it's kind of extra cool to do it in the context of one technology like WordPress, is that maybe I happen to know WordPress pretty well. So I'd be willing to kind of take on a mentee to help them level up just kind of for the good of the world, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty cool in terms of – I like that it's scoped to just one technology. It's not like I will teach you everything you know and how to do yoga at the same time. It's like, I'll teach you WordPress. I'm good at WordPress. So,
and it probably like because there'll be a little bit more action that way, right? People are a little bit more willing to sign up for something if they know the scope of it. Whereas I'm not sure I would sign up for like, I want to be your mentor in life. Mm-hmm. Much.
I like it. I think it's a good step. I think that's a great way to get people involved. So
maybe you could take your idea, Matt, and move it to make it like a Rails one or make like a, you know, gaming one, who knows, but scoping down mentorships to a technology is kind of an interesting idea.
And it sounds like they're looking for mentors, right? Like, because
I'm sure that will always be true, you know.
There's a lot of mentees looking for help. So if you know a bit about WordPress and you want to help, like, kind of teach people, get people on the WordPress train, and kind of the thing about teaching is it teaches you more because, like, you learn because you're teaching or whatever. It's this weird paradox, but that's worth checking out. Yeah, there you go. I did remember some drama. I don't know if you guys want to talk. Should we make it drama free?
Nope, do it.
Okay, drama. Here you go. You ready? Yep. Here we go. Giant Conf. I don't know if you were around last week, but it kind of blew up.
I remember. So you want to give us the background? You better.
I'll give you the background. So Giant Conf launches out of the gate, and it's like, kaboom, Giant Conf. There's like 76 speakers. It's very exciting.
First year.
Whitney Hess, who I'm a big fan of her work, but she said Giant Conf is sexist and not paying women. So that was like, whoa, you know how the internet responds to those sort of claims. That blew up. And then Sarah Parmenter decided to back out of Giant Conf on those grounds, but then she posted a blog post that was less about sexism, more about like her rate or her fees or whatever. It was like costing her money, like quite a bit of money to attend, like because the organizers pegged the fee limit for how much they'll contribute to, like $500 for hotel and $500 for flights, you know. And if Sarah's coming over from the UK, her flight's going to be way more than that. And she doesn't want to just come over for one night or whatever. So, yeah. So there are things like that. And then Giant Conf posted a reply very quickly. That was very awesome of them to post a reply. And they're like, it's not based on gender. We have been very conscious about like having diversity at the conference, but it's purely like what people asked for, like on their riders, if you will, like their speaking agreements or whatever. And so they're only paying the keynote speakers. Okay, you guys with me? So they're paying the keynote speakers, but it's five men and one woman. And the woman is Christina Halverson, who is helping actually organize the conference. So there you go. There's a little bit of diversity in the organizers, which always helps. But so therefore, you could argue it is being sexist because it's paying more men way more money than women. But then there's like, yeah, so that's...
Is it still going on or did it just blow over?
It's blown over, and Christina Halverson was very, she was very much like, those of you calling Giant Comp sexist need to shut up, basically, because she's like, it's like kind of the best thing. She says it's like been conducted really honestly or whatever. So I think what's come out of it, and this is maybe what the hot drama we can talk about is what it is really like. It's on you to kind of negotiate
as the owner of a conference.
As an owner of a conference, you need to know how much it costs to throw a conference before you get into it and invite 76 people to speak. But then there's the other side, like speakers, like you need to know how to price it. And yeah, so I don't know. Do you guys have any immediate gut reactions? Is Giant Conf awful, or are they screwing speakers? Can I say that? It's PG. Are they disenfranchising speakers by not paying them enough, or what's going on? What do you think? No, it doesn't even sound like drama now that
my gut reactions are guaranteed. They're not evil people. There's no way somebody starts a conference and is like, you know what? I'm out for the bad of mankind. So let's throw a conference in which to exploit them and their abilities. You know, like that's certainly not happening. Second of all, if Christina's involved and she's a woman and getting paid and choosing to pay other women, that's cool. Maybe it's not as diverse as it could be kind of thing. That's all. That's so tough. I don't know where to go with that. You know, do you force it the other direction? And I know we've talked about that before. That feels like sexism too, to force things the other way, because then you're like choosing based on sex, except for on ability. But sometimes maybe some forced stuff like that is the course correction that this industry needs. That's too hard. That's a huge question. And the other thing, maybe I should just shut up.
Settle down. No, I just think it's very, I mean, if you look at the roster of like 76 speakers, it's extremely, in my mind, they did a really good job at being very diverse. So it's not, you know, it's not just all white dudes with glasses and stuff. So that's really good. It's just kind of like, how do we,
the thing is as a speaker, don't you just, you have an email conversation with somebody, they say, this is what we're willing to pay, or you have a little negotiation or something about it. Nobody's forcing you to do it. And then you decide, am I going to do this or not based on that information? And you can decide yes, or you could decide no. Like, why does drama have to enter into it?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, I know.
For me, I if I'm paying $1,000 to go to a conference, I want the best lineup of keynote speakers that the conference can put together. So I would hate, in other words, that they just declined to have one person come because they had to, you know, meet a certain diversity requirement or put on a certain face to make the internet happy. I would want them just to find the best five or six keynote speakers they can get and put them up there to talk. And same on the other side. If I were a keynote speaker, I'd hate to think that I got picked, you know, for that position to kind of save face on the internet rather than, you know, because I was the best guy, you know, or gal for the job.
Right. And, you know, maybe the same thing I was mentioning works as an attendee too, though. Maybe you see a lineup of people and you see a price and you can decide whether those things are worth it and make an informed decision on whether you're going to go or not. Mm-hmm. Very difficult stuff here, but I'm glad we talk about it occasionally.
Yeah, I think the lesson for me was just like, wait for somebody to respond before you like get wrapped up into like escalating it, because like Giant Comp was very transparent, like, hey, listen, like we're not excluding by gender or something, like not paying people based on their gender. It's like purely like the negotiated price. And then we had to adjust our expectations because of what, you know, just our budget and stuff like that. But if you're interested in speaking and how much do I charge for things and stuff like that, Jen Lucas has an awesome post on the Nerdery.
Yeah.
I was standing over her shoulder
as she wrote that.
Were you? So yeah. It's
and I was hanging out with Christina awesome. when all this giant stuff went down, and then I was hanging out with Gene when the giant all stuff went. It was a very. This is like followed my life a little bit the last week. I feel very connected to it.
It's
all.
Chasing you, Chris. But it's really good. She's just like, what's your hourly rate? You know, and she plucks one out of the air. It's $100 an hour. That may sound like a fortune to you. That may sound like way not even close to you. Mm. But like, let's just call that whatever.
It's like three code kits an hour.
It's one number. And somebody else had a really good one. I think it was, oh shoot, who was it? It was Jessica Hish. She's like, how much her like rate or whatever is based on how much is five chairs at the conference or whatever. So that's how she kind of does stuff. But that said, you know, there's questions, you know, like if you're like, it's $100 an hour and it takes me 50 hours to prepare a talk, you know, or 20 hours, that's, you know, $2,000, you know, like, and that may sound like a lot to you to get paid, you know, especially if it's your first time speaking. So maybe you're like, well, for exposure, I'll discount a few hours. And, you know, it's kind of, you have to kind of think of it like a job, you know, like, I mean, it is a job, you know, but if you can recycle a talk, therefore your costs go down. If you're traveling, that you don't have to travel or it's like in and out, maybe that'll save you some costs. So think about that stuff, I guess, when you're proposing talks. Like, are you willing to take a hit? And if so, is that worth it to you? It's not the conference's job to make you rich.
Just
really.
Freaking use your brain and make decisions just like you do about how you freaking buy a new pair of shoes. It's the same thing.
Yeah. All right.
Hey, everybody. This Shop Talk Show episode is brought to you by Environments for Humans and their Access U Summit. That's accessusummit.com. We'll get you to the website you need to go at. It is a one-day conference on May 12th. It runs all day, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Central Time. It is their second annual one of these, and it's just a whole day dedicated to accessibility. So there's a bunch of speakers, and it's one day, and you can attend from anywhere in the world because it's online, and you can you know, watch the speakers and engage with the speakers through the website and ask questions and stuff. It can be pretty lively in there. It's pretty cool. So an all-day accessibility conference. How do you not go through that with talks like mobile accessibility by Henny Swan, ARIA and accessible JavaScript, stuff that we talk about on Chop Talk Show as much as we can. Accessible media for the web, meaning media like videos and audio. How do you deal with stuff like that? Things we're trying to get better at here on ChopTalkShow.com. So anyway, check out accessusummit.com.
Yeah. All right.
Economics. Let's talk about code kits some more. We have a question here from Hans Engelbrecht. Hans? Okay. Let's skip that. But it is Hans Engelbretson. He says, I use Grunt, but I also own a copy of CodeKit. I can never figure out a decent workflow. Grunt is too organic and often cumbersome to set up, but CodeKit doesn't allow me to run all the tools that I need. Do you have a recommendation for a better workflow, or is there a plan for some Grunt or Grunt-like task integration in CodeKit? God, that's got to be a common question, isn't it?
Every day.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I guess the Grunt topic comes up. It's kind of the elephant in the room lately. CodeKit predates Grunt and now Gulp. But those two tools came on about halfway through CodeKit 1's lifespan. And yeah, the internet has freaking gone wild with them. There's thousands of things you can do with Grunt and Gulp. My comment on the matter, and I'm just going to kind of address the whole Grunt and Gulp thing generally and then maybe answer the specific workflow question. But I figure this is a pretty common one, so I'll give the general response. You know, people sometimes assume that I hate Grunt or Gulp because, you know, they're a competitor with CodeKit. And I don't see the world that way, really. You know, I think Grunt and Gulp are fantastic tools, and they got, you know, great people behind them. And they really are. They're super powerful. But the problem is that, just like he pointed out, Hans, or however we're saying the name, they're not very approachable, right? You know, you have to really have some expertise or some experience, or you got to go and do some reading and learning to kind of use them and get them working for you. And that's the goal that CodeKit aims to solve is, you know, don't worry about writing a JSON file, just drag and drop, and it's ready to go. Put your project in the app, and you're done, you know, get to work. The problem is, though, that CodeKit exposes a GUI for many tools, but I can't do that for all 9,000 things that support, you know, Grunt, right? Because there's no way for me to automatically go, okay, here's this one library that works with Grunt. Yes. Now, let me put the options into a graphical user interface. Well, that requires manual work on my end. I got to go in, look at the tool, go, what are the options? You know, should this be a drop down? Should it be a checkbox? Put that into a GUI and then build it into CodeKit. And I've done that for the really popular stuff, like SAS
but it doesn't scale, and it doesn't scale exactly. For 9,000 things.
Whereas if you're using Grunt, well, now, you know, you can go into your JSON file and add a couple lines to set those options. You know, but there's no equivalent way to do that automatically for CodeKit. CodeKit can't just look at a Grunt component or a Grunt task and go, okay, well, here's how we should put together the UI for this. If that makes sense.
It does. I've long said that exact same thing. Like, I don't expect there ever will be a true, at least a good UI for Grunt. I've seen a few, you know, stabs at bad UIs for Grunt. Mm-hmm. But that's because a UI is crafted to deal with the task at hand. So look at the configuration JSON for every Grunt task. It's different for everyone. Mm-hmm. Yes, a lot of times there's, what are the input files? What are the output files? You probably could make a decent generic UI for those two things, but that's never all it does. You know, there's always more things. And if you're having trouble picturing what we're talking about, imagine something like processing a single SCSS file. And you can see the result of that if you go to CodeKit and you click on one of those files, a little sidebar pops out and it asks you all kinds of stuff. What output style do you want it in? Because there's different ways in SAS, you know, you can have it be very verbose or very compressed together. You need to offer that in the UI. What style? Do I want to output the debugging information or not? Do I want to make a source map or not? Do I want to use libsass or just regular Ruby sass? Do I want to bless it? Do I want to run auto prefix around it? Where do you want me to put it when it's done? Yes, that's a mouthful, right? But you need UI for all of that. That's the point. That's what makes CodeKit cool and useful. Mm-hmm. Now, grab another Grunt task, a random one that, you know, does something else. I mean, gosh, and look, there's a Grunt task that I've been using recently.
Grunticon.
Yeah, sure. Or the SVG store one that compiles SVGs together. That's super useful. I've been using that a lot, but it has its own little set of options. Like, do I want to maintain the attributes on the SVG file or not? Or do they get compressed? Do you want me to run it through SVGO first or not? And the UI for that is totally different, right? And that would require a bunch of new code. It just requires a new UI. I don't think there's any automatic way to turn that into a good UI. There might be an automatic way to turn it into a bad UI. But that, I guess that's the question that you face, right? Do you want to add some of these tasks to code? Do you want to just like wait for the best ones to surface and then those ones make it into CodeKit 3? I guess that would be like the generic plan, right?
Yeah, you know, so there's two ways that I approach the problem. A, I'm never going to be able to integrate every single tool, every single Grunt, you know, tool into CodeKit. It's just not possible. I don't have enough time to do it. And even if I did get all 9,000 in there, well, now like 300 of them are going to update every day. So the app is constantly falling behind. You know, that is the wrong way to approach it. But what I do see a lot is folks that want to use CodeKit but have to work in an environment where maybe the team, there's some Windows guys or what have you, is using Grunt. And right now, that is a little bit of a pain point because the two, you know, don't know about each other. And that is a problem that I think I am going to tackle and take on here.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that if you are working in a team that's using Grunt, right, CodeKit will perhaps read the Grunt file.
The Grunt file, yeah.
And pull out the settings that apply to the stuff CodeKit can handle, like your SAS files. So now, you know, CodeKit will automatically set the SAS files to use whatever the Grunt team is using. You know, and that way, if you are, you know, like Guy here, a designer on a team with a bunch of developers that are using Grunt to minify all their JavaScript and CoffeeScript and all that crap, you know, you can use the app and do it the easy drag drop way, but still not affect, you know, negatively affect the team where you're still, you know, using all of the team settings.
So then would you gray out the ability to change the file path in CodeKit? It would probably say, if you need to change where the output goes, you're going to have to do that in your Grunt file, kind of like the Compass days, you know, like you can't, you no longer have the ability to do that from the CodeKit UI. And would the Grunt file like supersede, like if it sees one of those, it's like, all right, I that's the master now.
Yeah, so the easy answer is yes. You would just say, all right, go edit this JSON file. The hard answer that's going to have me banging my head against the desk for a while, and probably the way I'll do it, is no, CodeKit will just update the Grunt file with the new settings anytime you change it.
That sounds incredibly difficult, but you know, yeah. That would be cool, though.
But that's kind of what I'm looking at, and this isn't like a tomorrow type deal, but
No.
It is and something that I want to do.
Next week.
Yeah.
No jokes about that. I'm sure this is kind of like a year long kind of project, probably. I mean, I don't know. I'm not going to put time frame out there at all. That's interesting though. Yeah, update the Grunt file when you that's pretty crazy. But it might live side by side with a CodeKit configuration file too, right? So one of them does have to kind of win, right? Meaning probably the Grunt file.
Well, you know, you're catching me off guard because I haven't really thought through the problem level of detail yet. Yeah. But something like that. But the end goal is to make it possible for a guy that wants to use CodeKit in a team with other people that are using Grunt to just have that seamlessly work. You know, and that is something I can tackle. But trying to integrate everything that Grunt can do into a UI environment and have that UI, you know, not suck, which is kind of CodeKit's claim to fame. The app doesn't suck. You know, that is a little bit of a Herculean task.
Yeah. Have you looked at like that Grunt DevTools extension, Chrome extension?
That's what I was kind of referring to.
I'm not like whatever making software recommendations. Don't listen to me. But it's handy because like you can visualize like a list of Grunt tasks and what they're doing. I don't know. You could probably do it better, but it's just an interesting, from like a design, it's a big design challenge, huh? To get that kind of
huge
into the app. Mm.
Mm. Well, let me real fast turn this around, ask you guys a question. If I was going to do this, should I do it with Grunt support or Gulp support?
Oh yeah. That's impossible to answer to, right?
I am on the Gulp train, but I'm using Grunt right now, you know, like I love Gulp, but just because of the way it's, you know, it's like functions. It's like JavaScript functions. So that's what I like about it. And I understand it. It reads like jQuery to me versus like the miles of JSON, the configuration, you know. That's tough.
And it hasn't really shaken out yet, so that's just impossible to answer. All I've done is my due diligence on both. I like dug into both and learned how they work, and I get it, and then did my best to explain to other people what they do and how they're useful. But honestly, I use neither. I use CodeKit, and I have a Rails project, and so I use the pipeline stuff. So it's kind of neither for me.
Nice. Chris, the check is in the mail. it's not a large check, you know. Don't go buy a new car.
No, good. So that I guess that's, you know, we could mention that a little bit as to, you know, this is not quite off the heels, but it hasn't been too long since CodeKit 2 came out, and it's pretty sweet. I don't know if I mean I guess as a longtime CodeKit user, maybe we could ask Guy, what was your did you kind of help with some kind of the decision-making stuff in 2.0 or at least voice your desires?
Yeah, there was some conflicts back and forth about how things should work. Because, you know, I primarily need CodeKit for just SaaS. Like, that is my mainstay. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't do a lot of JavaScript stuff. So I was very much like the linear workflow of dragging something in. How simple can we make that? And then Brian comes along. He's like, okay, well, I need to support these 50 other languages. I was like, oh, no, you don't. Like, you can just get rid of that. I just make it for me. But, you know, he was like, no, I got other people, you know, that actually pay for the app and want to use these different things. So we need to make that work. And, you know, after hearing about this grunt versus gulp stuff, you know, it was already a nightmare enough just to get all the options and figure out like a good style guide for managing all those settings just for what CodeKit 2 has now. I'm really worried about what's coming down the pike based off of what you guys are talking about. But overall, you know, the design, you know, it went pretty smoothly. There was some old iterations that Brian is having me put together that he wants to share. And I really don't want to share any of them because, I mean, if you want to talk about ugly looking apps, these things look like they're straight out of the 90s. And then we just kind of refined it, you know, tried keeping it simple. And It's what you have now.
It was different enough. Like, it's a little bit of a, it takes a minute to get used to 2.0 if you're on 1.0. I wonder if you have numbers on this. Do you still support 1.0 or do you feel like most, like of all the people in the world that have and use CodeKit, how many are on 1 and how many are on 2?
Right. So, you know, I don't know the exact split. I know a lot of them have updated, but I haven't issued any kind of alert, you know, to 1.0 users that says, hey, there's an update available. It's all just been kind of generic through the website. And the reason I haven't done that is because 2.0 is a whole separate app. It's actually a OS 10 sees it as a different thing. So you can't do the in-app update to 2.0. You got to go download the new bundle. Yeah. I don't know exactly how many have updated, but CodeKit 2 has done very, very, very well. Nice. You know, and I think I was surprised because after the launch, I was braced. You know, I set aside a week for all kinds of bug reports and stuff, and so far it's been pretty smooth. Little issues here and there, but no major catastrophes.
Yeah. That's good. It's slightly even surprising to me because I thought it was like different enough that it takes you a minute to appreciate all that can do. I guess the big ones for me were the fact that it has a server in it, which I always thought was a smart move because I don't know, a lot of people use a separate dev tool in their dock to run the server. So like, why not bundle that? And it seems like perfect territory for CodeKit.
Server, like Brian, we work at a coffee shop and Brian comes in, he's like, hey, check out what I've been working on. And he fires it up and I'm like amazed internally where I can't get words out. And what I end up saying is like, how do we make this better? And Brian is like looking at me like, you need to appreciate this. Like you need to say something.
Lay off,
cause boy. I just worked really, really hard on this. I'm like, that's great, but like we need to make it faster or do this, or you know, that's a horrible looking thing you did there, like let's fix that up. So I don't really give Brian the praise that he deserves on a lot of these really cool features. So clap clap, good job.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. It doesn't what I think is particularly cool is it hasn't actually replaced the servers that I need to run anyway, but because it exists and because things run through that server, that means that you get that refreshing, which is the killer. I mean, I almost like that more than the pre-processing almost. Yeah. The style injection stuff, like the fact that when I change something in my code editor, those changes, specifically the CSS ones, because the HTML ones and the JavaScript ones, in order for that to work properly, the page really kind of needs to refresh anyway. So that's fine. And that's useful too. Even just triggering the refresh is useful. But the killer one for me is when the page doesn't need to refresh and just injects those new changes. That's so awesome. And now that works everywhere. You can even open up the iOS simulator and go to that URL and it will work. Or you can go over to Browser Stack and run your little local thingy, the little local portal thing, and open up like something in Android or something, and it will do the style injection there. You know, like it doesn't matter where you're looking at that URL. If you can bring up the site, style injection works. And that's so awesome.
Didn't someone even get it to work outside of the local network?
Yeah, so it turns out if you got to go into your router to do this, but if you open port forwarding and forward port 5757 out, you know, to the world, you can have anybody in the world log into your computer, you know, and view that, well, not log into your computer, but go to that same address, and they'll see your local copy of CodeKit server hosting that site, and then it'll refresh live for them as well.
Oh, nice.
The caveat,
it's kind of like
there,
a poor man's WebRTC or something.
Yeah, I tested it with a guy that was over in Germany, and I could see his site, but it took forever to load, you know, because he's on the internet connection. There's just way too much latency.
Yeah, there's probably like 75 routers between you and him.
Yeah, but in theory, you could do that.
Yeah, pretty wild. So that was a long discussion over. We've managed to get pretty far without doing an ad. So
what's under the server? Is it just like is it PHP or just like Python HTML?
That's one of the things. I walked in to this coffee shop and I sat down with a guy and I was like, hey, check this out. I got this working. And he's like, well, it doesn't have PHP. Why don't you just build MAMP into CodeKit? And I said, well, that's because MAMP is freaking complicated and everybody does all of their own configurations and stuff. And I don't, supporting that would be a nightmare. So no, the server in CodeKit is a simple HTML server. It'll handle, HTML images, CSS, JavaScript. When you need server-side processing like PHP or mod rewrites or, Apache or all that stuff, now you've got to use an external server like MAMP, which is perfect for that. They've done a great job of, really honing in on that market. And then you just tell CodeKit, hey, MAMP is running my website. Just talk to MAMP when you need to serve the site. And CodeKit does that.
Which is through URL. It doesn't even care that it's MAMP. It
could be anything. Yeah.
Cool. That's cool. And you made a good, if you try to install PHP, you die. All of it. All right.
Campaign Monitor is one of our sponsors for the first time ever on Chop Talk. So thanks to them, they reached out about sponsoring. And I was like, you know what? We should have this anyway. So it's kind of a new-ish feature on ChopTalkShow.com. In the sidebar, there's just an input ad, for your email, and you type in your email and hit the button, you hit the button, and it does a nice little overlay thing, and that's where you type your email. But regardless of how it works, there's a then you're subscribed, and so when we publish a new show on Chop Talk Show, you get that email. And it took me to add that button to shoptalkshow.com took me like 6 minutes because the campaign monitor setup is so cool. I was like, from nothing, from not even having a campaign monitor account, I'm like, I should set this up. So I make an account, which of course takes 2 seconds, pick a login and password, and then use their RSS to email feature. And it's like, oh, what RSS feed do you want to use? Well, the one that WordPress generates on shoptalkshow.com. Plug that in, pick a template, pick some Shop Talk Show orange colors, and then call it a day. And then they're like, here's a little snippet for the little subscribe button you can put on your site. I chuck it on there, deploy it up, Beanstalk pushes it on the site, and we have a subscribe button on there. It literally took me under 10 minutes. I went in and cleaned up the design and stuff a little bit, but I just think that's so cool. And that's one of the features that Campaign Monitor offers, is that RSS to email thing, which I just think is so cool. But of course, it does all the other stuff too. Like, I have a list of all these people and I want to send a nice email newsletter to them. That's what they do and that's what they make easy. And it's one of those perfect web apps, I think, where like, this is one of those things that you really just shouldn't do by yourself. And they make it easy to do that. So there's some URLs they wanted to share. There's a campaignmonitor.com/top100 is a, it's a free ebook of the top 100 email campaigns that went out through Campaign Monitor. So like looking at ones that were awesome looking and successful and stuff's pretty cool. There's plenty of more stuff we could tell about Campaign Monitor, but it's an email sending service. They have lots of beautiful template stuff. Check it out at campaignmonitor.com. Let's do another question, Dave.
All right. This one comes in from Will McMahon. It's going to sound like a grunt gulp in CodeKit question, but it takes a turn. So here we go. I've started working with Grunt Gulp build systems and found an amazing benefit to my work. Many of the sites I work on are small static sites or prototypes. I have been using static site generators, Assemble.io, to speed up my dev work. I keep finding that I wish there were some more basic tools for processing HTML, templating, variables, and imports. Assemble is great, but needs to be heavily configured. Other options like Jade abstract the HTML so you're learning a whole new language. What are your thoughts on HTML pre-processing languages? Why aren't they more prevalent? And the line in the sand between an HTML pre-processing language and a full-blown static site generator? I think this is interesting. How do we feel about HTML preprocessing? We all like SAS. Everyone likes SAS. Everyone could maybe see the value of CoffeeScript, but then HTML, we're like, no, I'm going to write HTML.
Do you think that's the least popular of them? if you had to, I wonder, I don't really have any numbers on that, but it's kind of curious. And then there's different approaches to it too. Like Jade is, it really is a whole new language, as is Haml, kind of like you can't even write a div if you want to, you know, you have to use the number symbol and all that type of stuff. And then, but there's, you know, there could be a preprocessor that just like adds a little bit to actual HTML. It's like, you know, you could just write an include statement in there. And I guess I put this in there because CodeKit approaches it with kind of your own system. So maybe you could mention how that works and then we'll go from there.
Yeah. So it's called Kit, appropriately enough, the language. And all it does is add variables and import statements to regular HTML. And it does that with special comments. So you just write a comment in your HTML and you put the @ import, and then, you know, you bring in another HTML file or another Kit file. And that lets you, you know, combine files together really quickly. And then variables, you know, you can do, they're very simple. I erred on the side of simplicity for exactly that reason. You know, if you start to get really complicated and you want more power, well, now it's time to check out maybe Jade or Slim or Haml, which will do loops and for statements and, you know, everything you want there. But for the guys that, you know, just want to find a way to combine two HTML files together, Jade or Slim, you know, that's overkill, you know. So that's, Kit is very targeted at just the segment or that niche that wants to do just a little bit of work combining files, but not have to learn a new language, you know, like Chris was talking about. And there's a bit of dog fooding going on because Guy here wrote the entire CodeKit website in Kit. Yeah.
Sure. Why wouldn't he?
Was it good? It was so good.
Wow, that's nice. Yeah, because that's probably the one biggest missing thing from HTML. I'm always surprised when HTML isn't moving in that direction as far as the spec. And then along it came recently. There's a new spec called HTML Includes, and it totally doesn't do partials for HTML. It's like a different thing. It's like you link up another HTML, and like if there's scripts in that thing it links up, it will like load them all together. It's kind of like a way to load multiple scripts, but keep the HTML in your head clean or something. I don't even totally get it. But what it doesn't address is includes, which is that thing that everybody wants. You know, I would think if people are using Kit, that's what they're using it for. I mean, maybe a little bit of variables, but that's a little, you know, like I can't think of a ton of good use cases for that. You know, I mean,
there's nice been some there. Like we rigged up the CodeKit site because it's kind of repetitive structure. So we could just define a new variable to automatically add the ID in any classes we want every time it repeated that chunk of code. So you can get kind of creative with it, but
I'd be interested in it.
Yeah, it works pretty well.
So that I bet Will, who sent in this question, would be very interested to check out Kit, because what it isn't is a whole new language. It just adds a little layer that gets preprocessed, and it does it in like a forward compatible way, right? Because these comments aren't some special syntax; they're HTML comments, right? It's like
exactly, yeah.
And in the CodeKit app, you can tell it where you want the output file to go. Just FYI, I found it easier to have like a Kit folder, and I'll put index.kit in there, but tell it to output that into my root directory just to kind of have a nice clean root folder of all my HTML files.
Yeah. So there's plenty of, you know, as rare, as uncommon as HTML preprocessing is, I guess I'm just saying, I don't know if that's true, but I kind of suspect that it's probably the least used of the preprocessing choices. Even in that world, there's so many different options. Like, do I want to go whole hog on some weird thing, or do I want to go dabble in it a little bit, or do I want to have a preprocessor deal with it, or a site processor, I guess, is that a word?
Yeah.
But that's deal with. There's a lot of different choices there. So,
yeah, the problem is there's no real good medium. You know, there's HTML and then there's Jade, you know, which are two extremes, and there's not a lot of stuff in the middle there for people that want just a few additions to HTML, but don't want to, you know, radically write something different.
I agree. I've even looked into there must be a Grunt one, right? I was like, surely there must be HTML includes for Grunt that allows me to do the exact same thing that Kit does or something. And not no big deal. I'm happy to use Kit, but sometimes you're not in CodeKit. You know, sometimes you just happen to be on a Grunt project. And I didn't find anything that good. And I think Will probably found the same thing I did. Assemble, and Assemble's really cool, but it's super config heavy. It's not just really simple Grunt task that just looks at a HTML comment, sees a file path, goes and grabs that file and chucks it in there. That's what I wanted. And maybe there is one out there for Grunt, but I sure couldn't find it about 6 months ago, maybe. Let's do another question. Dave, you pick one while I think about.
Yeah, we got a audio question from Amit Kvint. Let's see here. I'm going to pull it up and on the old. Here we go. Doop, doop, doop. Here we go.
Hi, guys. That's nice. So I have a question. It's divided into two parts. First question, what is your workflow when deploying from local to remote? I use MAMP, CodeKit, Tower for Git. Especially, I want to know how do you handle the database with WordPress deployment, which seems to give a lot of problems, that even though I've done this for dozens of times already. Second part is, connected to that, what do you do when working with another developer on a WordPress project for version control, especially, again, with the database? I have loads of time-consuming issues with that. Like, each one has, like, a different setting of his MAMP or, you know, deploying databases that are different. Just, like, a bummer, really. Okay, thanks.
I like that Amit is calling from, like, the French Riviera.
I know, yeah. It's so serene. That was beautiful. Like, I was like, how could he be having problems? It sounds majestic. Okay. So his first question was kind of like deploying from local to remote using MAMP, CodeKit, Tower, right? And then he's having problems with the database on both of his questions. But then how do you kind of work with other people with this stuff? And and again, the database.
I don't know. DB deployment freaks me out a little bit. Some things I always worried about is like, why are people so concerned about this? You know, like I work on, this has happened on every set I've ever worked on. I never have 100% accurate copy of the live database locally. You often don't need it, you know, like you need some of it to work on features and stuff. It never needs to be 100% copy. Maybe it would be kind of cool if it was just because that's kind of nice, a convenience stuff, but you often don't need it to be. And especially it makes me nervous to like, I'm going to write this post on my local WordPress site and then push the database live. That sounds nasty. Maybe some of these problems can be solved by just thinking about your workflow in a different way. Like, why do you need this perfect copy of your database? Maybe I'll leave it at that. Let somebody else.
Side note, I wish WordPress had like SQLite for local.
Yeah, a flat file. That would be kind of nice. Isn't that how it works? It's a file that could even be in version control or something.
Yeah, it's a dumb file, basically. But anyway, so I'm sure Guy and Brian, you guys probably worked using CodeKit, at least in Git, for handing off the development of even the CodeKit site. Do you guys have any experience?
Oh, yeah, no, we have experience.
We have both worked in Git. This was our first time ever working with somebody else working in Git.
Yeah.
We shared the repository for the CodeKit website, and the very first time, Guy pushed his changes, and I went to update mine or something, and there were 723 conflicts that had to be manually resolved.
That didn't go well.
Because neither of us are very good with Git.
Yeah. That was a lot of it was Foundation stuff, I think.
Yeah, Foundation. We updated Foundation.
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, Guy can talk to working in WordPress. Unfortunately, you know, I spend all my time in Xcode, so I haven't really done a lot with WordPress in the past couple of years. But I know Guy builds sites with it, so
I tinker with it. I've almost been faced with the same problem in a indirect kind of way. I've always been trying to look into how to have those databases synced, not necessarily for deployment, but I was always going back and forth between my desktop and my laptop, and it would have been nice for deployment too. And I just threw up my hands. I couldn't find a good answer. This was a long time ago, just to remind you, like maybe there's something else out there now, but I just had to make the decision that this is my dev environment, and then there's my, you know, live environment that are two separate things. And I just try and keep my dev environment slim, so I'm not trying to duplicate, you know, the same exact functionality that I have locally versus what's on the server.
Chris, you use a DB Migrate Pro, right? The plugin?
Right. And they've sponsored the show a number of times. I think we're even lining up another one. So, you know, like whatever, journalistic integrity hashtag or something. But I use it, you know, like nobody knows me.
Hashtag cash
I don't even
money
know how to be, how to, whatever. Yeah, right. I use that, and that is cool because it goes both ways. You can pull down that. I tend to use it one directionally. I'll pull down the live database to my local database, and that kind of keeps it in sync, and then you're good to go. I don't know. It just is good. That's DB deployment for me. It's never pushing my local one live because that seems scary and weird, but it's pulling down the live one locally, and then they're in sync, and that's the goal anyway, right? Yeah, there was weird things with, I think this resolved, or either I was an idiot or something, but when you pull down, you have to make a choice. You have to kind of tell it what your local URL is going to be as you pull down the database from live, because it's a different URL for sure, right? Like your local one isn't yoursite.com. It's like yoursite.dev or yoursite.whatever you like it to be. And I just was being an idiot. I was like, well, I'm using CodeKit. So my site is actually Chris's MacBook Pro -4.local5757. So I took that and I put it in WPDB Migrate Pro, thinking that I'm telling it the new address that it should be at. And that's not what you should do. You should tell it what the MAMP one is.
Yeah.
And then, you know what I mean? So I guess
I guess the problem, I don't know if it's a problem. I'm sure they have a good reason for doing it, but WordPress stores everything in the database as absolute URLs, you know? So it tells, instead of having a relative path to where a page should be constructed, it says, you know, that it's at csstricks.com/, you know, this.
Yep.
So that makes it tough to move from the live back to the local environment.
It makes sense in content, because in content, like, it goes out to RSS and stuff, they have to be absolute URLs, but it is weird that they use it other places as well.
I'm not sure
why. Or they, I don't know, it's in the database and then they output it when a link gets generated. Whatever, that's the way it is. Okay, do we have time for one more? It's before an hour, right?
Yeah, we got time for one more, I think, if you guys are good. Yep. Matt Sekafin writes in, I'm sorry about your last name. So here we go. I messed it up. I have been building WordPress sites for years, but have recently been dabbling in other technology stacks like Angular, Node, Express, and Jade. I really enjoy working in Jade. So now going back and writing a combination of PHP and HTML and WordPress templates feels old school. I'm already compiling SAS and JavaScript in my WordPress themes using CodeKit, but I'm at a loss with how I might do the same with Jade. I'm not sure if this is even a good idea. I might be overcomplicating my workflow. What do you guys think? Have you had any success or desire to template in Jade within WordPress? So how
I know we're making this the WordPress show, but that's just how it is sometimes.
How do I put my HTML template into a templating language into a WordPress template? Hey.
It is tough. Well, you wouldn't use Kit probably because you're using PHP anyway. And if you just need an include, you'd probably just use an include in PHP or whatever. But how do you use Jade? The question really becomes, can you output PHP in Jade? Like after you process Jade, is there some kind of way that you can make Jade retain a PHP statement, or possibly even make it easier to write PHP? That would be kind of cool, right? Because who likes doing open bracket question mark PHP space? Ugh. Like, maybe they could abstract that out. I don't know. I don't know the answer to it. It's an interesting question, but you probably just wouldn't.
Yeah.
I mean, you can tell CodeKit to compile, you know, file.jade into output file.php.
Oh.
But I don't know that you can write PHP in Jade and then have it, you know, come out in the output file. Although Jade does have some kind of escape sequence, doesn't it? Where you can, you know, if you just have to write regular HTML, you just use their escape character and then you write what you want.
I think it's like a vertical pipe or something, or maybe that's slim.
Hyphen space, I think.
That's so, Camel has one too.
That would probably be how you'd do it. You know, if you need a snippet of PHP in there, you just escape it and then, you know, tell CodeKit to write it, not to, you know, file.html, but the output file should be file.php.
Yeah. That's clever. That could do it.
Yeah.
That could do it. Yeah.
But then it's a mess. Like, what do you get out of doing it that way? Not much.
Yeah. I mean, WordPress is so PHP heavy. You know, I would just think that most of your Jade file would just be escaped PHP at that point.
Yeah. It would be dumb.
Well, and where you use like PHP is like you echo things like in the class, right? Like section, you know, class, article, post tags or whatever the WordPress short tag is for like post data or whatever, post classes or something. There's kind of like, I don't even know if you could do that in Jade, like append a class based to an element based on the PHP output or something.
Oh, like
just
that. Be yeah. more escaped yeah. stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it doesn't seem like it gets you any benefits per se.
Like none almost.
Yeah, none. How much? None. That's tough. Yeah.
What a perfect place to end the show. We have no idea.
Hey, nailed it. I think it's probably you're stuck and you're overcomplicating it to some degree, right? That's fair. Huh. All right. That's my final word. Anyone else got anything?
Well, no, we have, no, you know, no. what do the proper do out, the proper ending.
Do the thing. Yep. All right, Brian, Guy. Thank you guys so much for coming onto the show. For those who aren't already following you guys and giving you money, how can people do that? And then each of you, what's one thing you'd like to plug on the internet? What's one thing?
Go first.
Yeah. Well, I want to say thank you to Chris. Chris picked up CodeKit long ago when I first launched it. He put it on his site and was like, hey, check out this cool thing. And he really had a lot to do with making the app such a big deal and so phenomenal. So I Yay. Would like to say thank you. As for what I want to plug, I would say Guy Meyer's website, but it's just a single page. I had to get on him for like 3 weeks to build himself a website. On the internet. He's the only designer without a website, and he tells me that is my thing. That's my calling card. Yeah. I don't have a website.
Oh my gosh.
I know. It's weird.
There's something weird with it, Guy.
It is. Right? I know. Yeah. It's just, I don't know. I'm never happy with it.
No, I mean, there's something actually weird with it. If you go to your if you go to your Twitter and click it, you get redirected to some crazy flower.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a fake URL. That's actually...
Oh, I get it. All right.
Designerwithnowebsite.com.
Yeah. That's nobody me. Click that. It does not take you to anywhere you want to go.
There. Sorry, I should probably change that now.
Put like, you can't you put like a non-breaking, a zero width space between the the period or something? Kill it.
Right, okay. Right. I don't know. If you guys, anyone wants to follow me, I'm at a generic guy on Twitter. I will plug my beautiful wife, who I believe is listening right now. If anyone out there is getting married and you're in need for wedding stationery, harkinpress.com. Check it out.
That is a proper plug. Nice. Good for you.
They got this giant letterpress. It's like an 8,000-pound letterpress. Takes up a whole garage to do the stationery.
Do it one more time. I want to. What's the URL?
Harkin, Harken, press.com.
There you go.
Money.
Awesome. Very much. Thanks you guys very much. And thank you for listening to the Shop Talk Show. You guys make my world go round.
I like this comment. He wanted a warm dinner tonight. I like that person.
Awesome. Thanks everyone for coming out in the chat room. You are the best. Thank you for downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to rate us up in your marketplace of choice. We really appreciate you. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to add?
ShopDocShow.com.